This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Recently, there's been talk about returning citizenship and character education to public schools across the country. This has caused some controversy, as you might expect, but according to at least one national educator, it really shouldn't.
Schools have no choice about teaching character because they're already doing it all day long.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, a discussion about character education. Later, we'll hear from a mental health trauma expert about the aftermath of another school shooting. Then we'll lighten the mood a bit with some preschoolers talking about their favorite TV character and spend an academic minute looking for the abominable snowman. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. When you talk about teaching character in public schools, you can expect to get some pushback. But say you want to help students with grit, self-control, honesty, compassion, and responsibility, well, you might end up getting applause. I recently traveled to a seminar on character and citizenship education and met Ron Berger. Ron is the chief academic officer of EL Education, which we'll hear about in a minute. First, though, I asked him to define what he means by character education.
I feel like public schools were founded in America partly for academics and partly to build character and citizenship in our population so that we can have a democracy. As a new democracy, when America was formed, it was clear to the founders of America that we needed public schools that would help imbue strong, virtuous character and citizenship in students. And that's still at core to the purpose of public education in America. It's just not what we talk about so much these days. Unfortunately, we spend most of our time talking just about test scores. And although basic skills in math and reading are vital, they're not the only purpose of public schools.
They are, however, the easiest things to measure.
Exactly right. And I think because they're easy to measure, it's easy to rank things like that. It ends up dominating all of our conversations. So a mastery of academic skills is, of course, really important. But the kind of human beings that are coming out of our schools is just as important. And I think some people might say, well, schools don't have time to teach character because they have to stick with just academics. Or they might say character shouldn't be the purview of schools, really. That should be family or faith-based. My response to that is that schools have no choice about teaching character because they're already doing it all day long. So the experience of schooling imbues character values in students, either well or not well. So schools can only choose to do it well or poorly. They can't choose to not teach character.
How are they doing it and not knowing it?
So the experience of schooling makes a kid either more courageous academically and personally or less so, more courteous and respectful or less so, more compassionate and understanding of other points of view or less so. So everything about the way school works is forming kids. And kids are in school longer each day than they are with their families, actually, longer than they're in church. So school is a very powerful force in shaping the kind of human beings we're creating. Are they compassionate, courageous, respectful, responsible human beings? Schools should explicitly work with that so that we're clear that we're doing our best job in schools of turning out the kind of human beings and citizens that we value.
Character and values have taken on a different meaning in the context of schools than they did perhaps years ago, maybe a more religious thing or a more conservative thing now. Is there a way to, for the lack of a better word, sell this to people then that would work?
It's a great question, and I think we need to diffuse that polarity of a sort of this is so controversial, no school could take it on. Because I think we certainly have different points of view in this country and different faiths, and we have different partisan political views. But I think what's interesting is that if I were to name some of the virtuous character habits, things like respect, responsibility, courage, compassion, kindness, integrity, honesty, I don't think there's anyone in America who doesn't wish their kids would have those values. I think those cut across faith. I think they cut across skin color. I think they cut across country of origin. I think there are some shared values here in America that people do want their kids to be courageous, kind, respectful, responsible kids, courteous kids. Like, we actually all value that no matter where we were born or who we are. And so I think it's not actually controversial for schools to work hard at imbuing those values in kids. If a school district or a school says, we're going to start a character education program, it makes everybody nervous. They think, whose values are you teaching? But if that same school were to say, our school is going to focus very heavily on respect and responsibility, compassion, kindness, and courage, I think no one in the community would be upset. They think, great, that's just who we want our kids to be. So it's gotten a political edge right now that feels controversial, but I think underneath, the actual character values are ones that we all embrace.
Would there be a curriculum that you'd be able to get whoever is sitting on a school board to all agree on for that?
Well, there are a lot of different character curricula out there right now, and social-emotional learning curricula, mindset curricula, grit. I mean, there's all these different words that are used to describe character. And there's a lot of published commercial curricula that are out there. Many of them are excellent. But I think the truth is a curricula is not enough. That the most important thing about character in a school is how adults in the building are modeling character for their students. So the adults in the building need to model those values. They need to model being respectful, compassionate, courageous with each other and with students. Because really kids are going to learn more from the experience and what they see adults doing than from the curriculum that you're using.
Tell me about EL Education. What's the company?
So we're a nonprofit. We've been around for 25 years. And we were formed from a marriage of Harvard Graduate School of Education and Outward Bound USA, which is the wilderness organization that actually uses the wilderness not to teach wilderness skills, but to teach character. So in Outward Bound experiences, kids or adults come together in the wilderness and as a team have to figure out how to get to the top of the mountain together. They have to lean on each other. They may struggle, they may cry, they may fight with each other, but eventually they learn to work together and make it up and support each other to the top of the mountain. We use that same vision as a metaphor for our schools. For our kids, it might be every kid getting into college, every kid developing a good character values and entering a good vision for their careers. But it's that same, we're all doing it together, team spirit that Outward Bound brings. And also that same spirit of we're going to take on work that's harder than we think we can do and succeed in it together.
And how wide-reaching is your organization? Where do you go?
So we're really two things. We're a network of about 150 schools across 30 states. We don't own those schools. We're not a charter management organization. We're a partner with public schools. We work with district schools and with charter schools in 30 or something different states right now. And we also have a free open source literacy curriculum, which is it's been downloaded about 9 million times now, that's used across the country, that imbues character right along with literacy. And we also produce open source videos, books, resources around these issues so that we can reach more students that are beyond our network of schools.
How do you tailor something like that so that it would work in Western Massachusetts and Southern Alabama?
Great. It's such a great question, Bob. And I live in Western Massachusetts. I live in a small rural town, and I was a public school teacher there for more than 25 years. But I spent a lot of last year in Alabama working with schools that were trying out some of these practices. And even though there were big differences, I mean, I'm a New Englander, they're Southerners, and I root for the Patriots. They hate the Patriots. You know, like, we have a lot of differences. And I'm an old white guy from New England. A lot of them were African-American educators in Southern Alabama. And yet, we're both working with low-income students. We're both having this vision that we want students to be great scholars and great human beings, to have strong character. And so just the strategies that our books or our videos embody, like having students lead their own family conferences, having students present evidence of their thinking and defend their thinking, are ones that they were using, we coach people to do, and so we had a lot of common ground. I loved working in Alabama with teachers.
Do you see character education expanding in the country in the years to come?
I sure hope so. I feel like it's essential that we return to sort of the roots of public education, which is public schools are about basic skills in math and literacy, and they're about creating great people and great citizens. And I think we have to return to that to have a good civil society and to have a strong democracy. So I hope it gets less controversial, because I actually think the values that we're talking about are ones that aren't so controversial. It's just the topic of character education that I think can become controversial.
Ron Berger is a veteran educator and the chief academic officer of EL Education. My thanks to the Education Writers Association for their invitation and scholarship to their Educating for Character and Citizenship seminar. Now, we've had some time to digest the tragic school shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in South Florida a little over a week ago. Nicholas Cruz took an Uber to his former high school and in a little over 10 minutes killed 17 people and sent hundreds of students fleeing into the streets. It was the nation's deadliest school shooting since a gunman attacked Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut in 2012. Dr. Amy Nitze is director of the Institute for Disaster Mental Health at the State University of New York in New Paltz. She spoke about the possible mental health effects for survivors of this and other mass shootings with the best of our knowledge's Allison Dunn.
Sort of one of my benchmarks is the Columbine shooting, which happened while I was in graduate school studying psychology. And from that event until now, the increased frequency of these has become such that, you know, one of my biggest concerns is that as a society, as a collective, if you're not from the community in which one of these incidents is happening, that they've really become almost, and I hesitate to use this word, but they've almost become ordinary or commonplace. The frequency also draws our attention from one to another so quickly that I think we forget, maybe not forget, but I think that we gloss over the depth of each of these tragedies as an individual incident, as an individual tragedy. And I think that leaves us with a problem of not fully grasping what this level of violence says or means for us as a society.
She says the Florida school shooting can stir up emotions in communities that have experienced similar tragedies, including for mental health professionals and first responders.
You know, we use this term collective trauma to describe that phenomena where, you know, an entire group of people that are connected in some way are impacted in a way that where they create sort of a shared meaning around that. And unfortunately, now we have Sandy Hook here and multiple other communities across the country who are going to continue to be reminded and triggered over, you know, any number of years by the ongoing nature of these events. And so, you know, as a community continues to grapple with the loss and to make some meaning of it for themselves, these incidents just continue to keep bringing it up in a way that may perpetuate conversation in a way that otherwise wouldn't happen.
Nitze says the Florida school shooting may provoke reactions in students who were at Sandy Hook.
I mean, there's no right way for a child to grieve or to have a trauma reaction. And certainly for many of those kids, a real trauma reaction could occur. And so I think giving each child and, each group of children the space to have whatever reaction they're having and to be supported in getting whatever support they need. If a classroom wants to talk about it, needs to talk about it, that can certainly be helpful. There may be others who don't want to or can't verbally express what's going on with them. So for children, they need to be reassured in a realistic way that they're safe. That's really hard when you've been in a situation where you weren't safe. I guess my biggest recommendation there is to follow the lead of the children and not force them into one way of doing that.
Authorities say the 19-year-old suspect had been expelled from Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland for disciplinary reasons.
I think the need to assign blame or to find someone to put the problem on, I think that prevents us from having the hard conversations that we need to have and to be able to gather data and look at the facts and really try to approach this as a public health problem, which at this point it really is, as opposed to a political problem or a Second Amendment problem or whatever. I hope that where we're going is that we are able to stop and have a conversation, be able to collect the data that we need to be able to look at how, from a public health perspective, can we stop this? And I don't know the answer to that, but I know there have to be answers. We've been able to cut down deaths and other, you know, children drowning in swimming pools by passing legislation that there needs to be fences. And we've been able to cut down motor vehicle deaths by having people wear seatbelts. And so if we look at it through that frame, I think the solutions are out there.
The Institute for Disaster Mental Health's 15th annual conference in April will be focused on the psychosocial response to mass violence. It's a topic, NHTSA points out, that unfortunately is timely practically any year.
Because the collective conversation is difficult to have, and we have not yet been very successful at looking at this through a facts-based lens or a data-driven lens, we're left to talk about what do we do as a response. And so we're getting pretty good at knowing what do we need to do as responders. But the problem then becomes we shouldn't have to be responding so frequently. And so I hope that we're able to, at some point here, we're able to stop and take a collective deep breath and reengage around getting really good at preventing and not just good at responding.
Reporting for the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Allison Dunn.
Still to come, a popular PBS children's character is having a big effect on some preschoolers. That story's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about the Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. In a Western New York preschool classroom, a teacher is using the popular PBS Kids character, Daniel Tiger, in her lessons. From station WBFO, senior reporter Eileen Buckley says it's helping to develop social and life skills for these kids.
It's not Daniel the Frog?
Daniel Tiger!
It's Daniel the Tiger.
Preschoolers at Saints Peter and Paul School in Williamsville are big fans of Daniel Tiger. They can tell you about episodes and what they've learned.
He be nice.
Does he teach you how to be nice to your classmates?
Yes, because he teaches me how to tie my shoes.
All right, my
friend. Preschool teacher Michelle Ganshaw instructs 3 and 4-year-olds at the school. She incorporates Daniel Tiger lessons for both age groups in her classroom.
Whenever I'm doing my plans for the month, I check to see what Daniel Tiger has to offer because it's easier for the children to understand a lot of things when it's more on their level and they get the basic concepts, and then we'll be able to apply it to what they have to do during the day. So Daniel is used a lot in the classroom.
A study published a couple of years ago reviewed preschoolers watching Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood. It found those young students displayed high levels of empathy and confidence in themselves in social situations.
It shows that the life skills, and it shows the morals that we would like to instill to our children at St. Peter and Paul, beginning at the ages of 3 and 4 years old, so that way they can carry it through to their lives forever.
Daniel Tiger is helpful in developing social skills, but the study pointed out children experience benefits when they have regular discussions with their parents. But in Ganshaw's preschool classroom, those conversations are reinforcing the lesson from the episodes.
And after we're done watching Daniel, I make sure that we talk about what happened to Daniel and how we can use it within our lives and within the classroom. Today, for example, we watched Daniel got sick and how he couldn't go to a birthday party because he was sick and how sad he was.
Hi, Dad. I'm sick.
You do feel warm. Come on. Let's get you home.
The children understood that, you know, you have to get better if you want to be able to do different things. So it was a good stepping ground for them, and talking because of the flu and everything happening now, I wanted them to see that.
We're going to have strawberry birthday cake.
I'm sorry, Daniel.
And why do you like Daniel Tiger?
Because he misses the birthday party.
What happened with that? Can you explain that? I don't know about that.
He got sick.
They'll go home and tell their parents what they listened to that day, and their parents will come back and go, wow, where did they get that from? So they're not actually saying, well, we watched it on Daniel Tiger, but they'll go home and state what they had learned through Daniel. So that's kind of cool that I don't have to say anything. The children are just going home and saying what they have to say.
These young students react well to a visual lesson. And Ganshaw says she highly recommends to other preschool teachers to incorporate Daniel Tiger.
I think it is one of the best ways to show the children what you mean when you're talking about a specific article or a specific idea. Children these days need visuals to understand more what's happening, and Daniel definitely shows it in an age-appropriate way.
It's a beautiful day in the neighborhood, a beautiful day for a neighbor.
And just as past generations learned social lessons while watching Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, this modern-day cartoon created by the Fred Rogers Company featuring Daniel Tiger is certainly hitting home for these young students.
He's kind of considered the modern-day Mr. Rogers.
Absolutely. He is the modern-day Mr. Rogers. And that's what I tell people. When people say, who's Daniel Tiger? I'm like, well, in our time, he was Mr. Rogers. So with the trolley and just even the concepts that he uses and the other characters besides Daniel, like the owl who Mr. Rogers had and so on and so forth. So yes, he is Mr. Rogers.
It's Daniel Tiger's neighborhood, a land of
all right, so are you guys ready to talk to Miss Buckley about Daniel?
Why do you like Daniel Tiger?
Because I learned out stuff.
What do you like about Daniel Tiger?
I play Daniel Tiger games.
Do you like Daniel Tiger?
Yeah.
Why?
Because, well, I like him.
Eileen Buckley, WBFO News.
Won't you ride along with me?
You know it's been a long winter when we get around to talking about the Yeti, otherwise known as the Abominable Snowman. But there it is. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
On this Student Spotlight, has a Yeti specimen been found? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Stephanie Gill, PhD candidate at the University at Buffalo, discusses the samples found in the Himalayas.
A couple years back, our lab was contacted by a British production company called Icon Films. The company was working on a documentary about the Yeti legend, and they had obtained several alleged Yeti specimens. They had a question. Could we help test the DNA of these purported Yetis? There were 9 samples in all, including specimens like a femur bone from a cave in Tibet and a scrap of mummified skin from the paw of an unknown animal. We agreed to analyze the samples. Our investigation showed that most of the samples did come from enigmatic creatures, but not from Yetis. One specimen, a tooth, belonged to a dog. The other 8 belonged to native bears, species that live at high elevations and are rarely seen. 6 samples were from Tibetan brown bears, 1 from a Himalayan brown bear, and 1 from a Himalayan black bear. Our results provide insight into the possible origins of the Yeti myth, which is part of the folklore of the Himalayas. They suggest that this legend may have its roots in sightings of elusive local bears. In addition, our research sheds light on the evolution of vulnerable bear populations. We sequenced the first complete mitochondrial genome of a Himalayan brown bear and discovered that these bears represent an ancient evolutionary lineage of brown bears. Additionally, we found that the Himalayan brown bear is very genetically dissimilar to the Tibetan brown bear. This suggests that these 2 species colonized the region at separate times and have been isolated ever since. Myths have a way of persisting, so I don't think our work will put the Yeti legend to rest. But we can hopefully draw some attention to the plight of other enigmatic creatures, these rare, mysterious bears of the Himalayas.
That was Stephanie Gill of the University at Buffalo. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.